On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The pain at the pump has seemed relentless. The average gas price nationally could top $4 a gallon this week. Maybe it's peaking, maybe it's not. But with world demand on the rise, gas prices are likely to be a recurring issue for a long time. They've been front and center in election year Republican attacks on President Obama. And Obama's striking a gung-ho all-of-the-above energy pose himself right now. This hour on Point, how much can a president really do about gas prices, and what should American policy be? You can join the conversation in a time of global markets. Can the American president bring down the price of gas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Ads have been flying already, plus plenty of commentary on the campaign stump. Here's an ad from the Mitt Romney campaign going after President Obama's track record on energy.
The Obama attack machine has started, spending millions to sling mud or oil at Mitt Romney. Why? Because in the five states where Obama's attacking Romney, gas prices have roughly doubled. But Obama's mud can't cover up his failed energy policies, policies that are hurting small businesses and working families. America deserves solutions, not attack ads covering up Obama's failures.
And that's kind of the least of it from that angle. Obama's campaign itself hitting back. Here's a new ad from the Obama corner defending the president's record on energy.
Under President Obama, domestic oil production's at an eight-year high. So why is big oil attacking him? Because he's fighting to end their tax breaks. He's raising mileage standards and doubling renewable energy. In all these fights, Mitt Romney stood with big oil for their tax breaks, attacking higher mileage standards and renewables.
We're going to hear a bunch of perspectives in this hour. Joining me first today from California, Severin Borenstein, co-director of the Energy Institute at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, also professor of business administration there. Severin Borenstein, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi.
So where are we on gas? Do you think we're going to see even higher gas prices? It all depends on oil, I guess. What do you see coming?
Well, I think the best guess is that gas prices are likely to stay about where they are through the summer and then gradually drift downward. The oil markets are very high right now, but actually the futures prices for oil and gasoline looking out 6 or 12 months are a bit lower than they are right now. So it's very hard to predict, but I think the best guess is that we will see a gradual decline.
And so maybe we're peaking, maybe a gradual decline. Nobody's likely to let go of the issue if they can help it, though, and it's painful for people right now. What about this big question of the White House and gasoline prices in this country, Professor Borenstein? How do you look at the relationship there?
Well, there isn't much relationship. I think pretty much all economists across the spectrum agree that there's very little that the president can do to change the price of oil. And the price of oil is the primary driver of the price of gasoline. The price of oil is set in the world market. The United States, even with our big increase in production over the last few years, is still producing about 10 or a little less than 10% of the world's oil. If we were to produce a lot more, that would, meaning another million barrels a day, that would cause prices to drop a tiny bit in the world oil market, because it would only add 1% to that market. And so the main driver is what's going on worldwide in both production and in demand. Demand is very strong right now, particularly from the developing world, where there are a lot of people coming out of poverty. And one of the things they want when they come out of poverty is motorized transportation, and that increases the demand for oil.
It doesn't mean that it's not a political point of pain in this country, and everybody knows it. This is Mitt Romney here. This was March 18th on Fox News, saying that the president has wanted gas prices to go up.
Well, there's no question but that when he ran for office, he said he wanted to see gasoline prices go up. He said that energy prices would skyrocket under his views, and he selected three people to help him implement that program, the Secretary of Energy, the Secretary of the Interior, and the EPA administrator. And this gas hike trio has been doing the job over the last 3.5 years, and gas prices are up. the right course is they ought to be fired, because the president has apparently suffered a election year conversion. He's now decided that gasoline prices should come down.
Mitt Romney going after President Obama and what he calls his gas hike trio. Again, the Obama camp firing back. Here's that super PAC that supports the president, Priorities USA, put out this ad attacking Romney on energy.
Who's behind this ad smearing President Obama? Big oil. That's who. The money they make from high gas prices is going right into Mitt Romney's campaign. Big oil executives have pledged $200 million to help him. And Romney's pledged to protect their record profits. And their billions in special tax breaks, too. These guys all profit. You pay the price.
Severin Bornstein is with us from the Haas Business School at University of California, Berkeley. What about the complaint? And, of course, the New York Times has looked and said, well, Mitt Romney said something similar. But that President Obama himself or those around him have said over time that they want higher gasoline prices because that would open up room for alternative energies to flourish. Does that factor in?
I don't think the president or any of the administration has said they want higher oil prices in order to raise gas prices. At the time the president came into office, politicians on both sides of the aisle were supporting some sort of cap-and-trade program or tax on carbon emissions, which would have raised gasoline prices. It would have also raised revenue for the country. And the idea was by recognizing the damage that CO2 emissions does to the environment, we could, and by taxing it or having a cap-and-trade program, it would raise the price of gasoline. And by doing so would raise revenue and would encourage people to move off of using fossil fuels. Of course, since then, the whole idea of climate change and doing something about global warming has really taken a political dive, even though the science is stronger than ever. And as a result, no one's talking about that now.
But they have. I mean, Secretary Chu said before he was secretary, before Obama had even won, but he'd said, you know, we need to boost the price of gasoline to the levels in Europe. Is it possible that that attitude has something to do with the higher price of gas?
I think it's not like there's no evidence, and it's pretty hard to see how it possibly could. The reason the price of gas is high is because the price of oil is high. Partially that's because the U.S. economy is starting to rebound. More so, it's because the developing world's economy is doing pretty well and their demand is going up. We have seen increases in oil production in the United States, but at the same time, we've seen some pretty significant decreases in other parts of the world. Mexico has had real trouble. We've seen problems in the Middle East that have reduced production in Libya, in Iraq, of course, in Nigeria and Africa. And that's what's driving up oil prices. Whether Secretary Chu wants high oil prices, I think he very much doesn't. What he wanted and what he was referring to there was taxes on gasoline, not high oil prices that would cause high gas prices. And that was part of the general idea that we should be moving off of fossil fuels, which has, of course, changed quite a bit since then politically.
Of course, a lot of people still feel that, but then here comes the pain at the pump. What about, we all remember in 08, drill baby drill being chanted at the Republican convention. Let's just go back to that. You say we can't drill our way out of this, but explain that. Why not? If it was all, you know, no holds barred, and this, you know, the environmental consequences could be very serious, but if it were, does the United States have the capacity to change the balance? What has happened with our drilling in recent years?
Well, first of all, drilling and production has gone up. That's not due to President Obama. That's due to technology improvements that have made it possible to reach oil that wasn't reachable before. As a result, U.S. production has increased. But the constraints we face are not primarily environmental. They're primarily geological. The fact is there just isn't very much oil around the United States that would be cost competitive. The oil that we could produce if we opened up all of these new areas, even by the estimates of the oil industry, would increase production by about 1 million barrels a day. Now, that would bring in a lot of money for both the oil companies and their workers and some tax revenue. But a million barrels a day in a market that by then, we're talking a decade out, would be 100 million barrels a day, just doesn't change the world price of oil. The thing we have to remember is that the price of oil is not set by in the United States. We are part of this world market, and that's a good thing because we have for many decades relied on imports. If we hadn't been part of the world market, we would have had much, much higher oil prices and a real shortage. So the fact is that we remain part of that world market. We're not going to be able to change that. There isn't enough oil reachable in the United States. So drilling would create value, but it would not fundamentally change the balance we face in the world oil market.
What's the bigger factor in the gas price run-up recently? And, of course, you've seen them before. We saw a big run-up under George W. Bush. But is it supply constraints or is it geopolitical tensions? I mean, we've talked on this show about the Strait of Hormuz and the potential for war with Iran and oil suppliers looking at that and oil traders looking at that. How does that factor in?
It's both, but it's probably more on the demand side, because although there are these tensions in the Middle East that they're not actually blocking supply at this point. They caused a slight buildup in inventories, which is precautionary in case there is some sort of problem in the Middle East. But inventories haven't really ballooned. Most of what's been going on is that there's a lot more consumers worldwide who are willing to pay for oil than there were 10 years ago. And that's because China is becoming wealthier and India is having more people come out of poverty, and the rest of the developing world is increasing their demand for oil.
And more to come. So what do we do? What could be done at the White House level is the issue on the campaign trail. Severin Bornstein, please stand by there in California. Listeners, we're talking about gas prices, global markets, and presidential power. Do you believe the president can bring down the price of gas? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about gas prices, global markets, and presidential power, the price of gasoline in America, and what a president can or can't, should or shouldn't do about it. We're at 800-423-8255. What energy policy are you looking for when it comes to the price of energy, the price of gas? Is Newt Gingrich blowing smoke when he says he'd bring $2 gas, $2.50? Is President Obama on the right track with his all-of-the-above energy policy? Could Mitt Romney do better? We're at 800-423-TALK. How do you see this challenge, these prices, these markets? Here's Newt Gingrich in February talking with Greta Van Susteren on Fox.
If we allowed federal land to be developed, we would have a shocking amount of energy. We would, in fact, rapidly become independent of the Middle East. No American president would ever again bow to a Saudi king. And we'd get gasoline prices back down to $2 or $2.50.
When?
We could eliminate CAFE standards. You don't need CAFE standards if, in fact, you're moving towards inexpensive gasoline.
Newt Gingrich in February, no bowing to Saudi kings, $2 gas, $2.50, no CAFE standards, and off we would go. All beautiful. There are tough ads out there on the president's policy right now. Here's one from the American Energy Alliance. We'll hear from a representative in just a moment. They are paying to run this ad in eight states, swing states in the presidential election.
Since Obama became president, gas prices have nearly doubled. Obama opposed exploring for energy in Alaska. He gave millions of tax dollars to Solyndra, which then went bankrupt. And he blocked the Keystone Pipeline, so we will all pay more at the pump. Obama's energy secretary said we need to, quote, boost the price of gasoline to the levels in Europe. That's $9 a gallon. But what does he care?
I don't own a car at the moment.
Tell Obama we can't afford his failing energy policies.
They're the tough kind of ads that you're going to hear in a lot of states around the country. Factcheck.org says there's a lot of problems with that. We'll ask about that. Severin Bornstein is with us from the University of California's Business School. The Haas School of Business there joins us today from Berkeley, California. With us right now as well from Washington is Thomas Pyle, president of the American Energy Alliance, paid $3.6 million to put together ads running critical of President Obama's energy policy. American Energy Alliance, closely tied with the Institute for Energy Research. According to Politico, they've got a lot of money there from the Koch brothers. Thomas Pyle worked for Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, big in energy in this country, from 2001 to 2005 as director of federal affairs. He's got tough views on President Obama's energy policy and joins us right now. Thomas Pyle, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom.
What's the president got right? What's he got wrong, in your view?
Well, I guess the question you have to ask is if these folks were not pursuing policies that would, as Energy Secretary Chu said, increase the cost to the level of Europe, then what does it look like? Because what doesn't it look like? Because as far as I can see, at every level, their objective has been quite clear, and that is to increase the cost of doing production of fossil fuel in this country and increasing the cost of fossil fuel in this country, and at the same time spending billions of dollars propping up wind, solar, and other quote-unquote renewables and increasing, vastly increasing the regulatory state with respect to these types of energy. So can the president do something to lower gas prices? You bet. Almost everything opposite of what he's currently been doing for the past 3 years.
So what do you say to these surveys, and we've seen them, of economists right across the board? I mean, they're asked, and almost to a man and woman, they say, no, the president cannot in any foreseeable term change the price of gas. Why is that such a widely held view?
Well, I guess the question is why can't they? Because, for example, when President Bush lifted the offshore moratorium, the price of crude on the world market dropped by $9.26, or 6.3%, simply after the announcement was made.
But gas prices soared under President Bush, as you know.
They did, and they went down when he started making the decision prior to the crash. The price went down when he sent a signal to the world market that the United States was going to get serious about producing more on federal lands. Right now, production on federal lands is down significantly, almost 250,000 barrels a day. We're at a 9-year low on fossil energy production on the federal lands. That is not a coincidence. The president keeps saying we're at an 8-year high on production, but he doesn't tell the folks that it has nothing to do with his actions. It has everything to do with the increase in production on private and state lands. So you have to ask yourself, If a series of steps that the president can take can send signals to the market that the U.S., the number three producer of crude oil in the world, is going to strive to be that number one producer, and then I would agree wholeheartedly that we can definitely do something, that our leadership can definitely do something about the price of gas.
Severin Borenstein, some 90-plus percent of the increased drilling that's gone on has not been on federal land. That's from independent observers here. And Tom Pyle says, you know, the president could open up those federal lands and yahoo, off we'd go. What do you say, Severin?
Well, he certainly could open up federal lands more than he has. And, you know, the goal, of course, is to balance opening federal lands and having more drilling against environmental problems. You know, it would certainly create a lot of value to produce more oil, but as we saw in the BP blowout in the Gulf, that there are real dangers to that as well. Responsible policy on oil is going to balance those two. It's not going to say we should just open up everything, and of course it's not going to say we should just shut everything off at the same time. But regardless of that, you know, whether you're talking about opening all federal lands, including off the coast of California and off the coast of Florida, as these numbers often do include, it's just not going to produce enough oil that's going to fundamentally change the world market. One can always find cases where an announcement was made and the price of oil moved,
yep,
and claim that one caused the other. But in fact, the economics are pretty clear that the sort of changes we see with opening up one new area or changing one policy just are not enough to move the world market for oil. And that is why 99% of economists agree that there's nothing the president can do to actually change the price of gasoline. That doesn't mean energy policy doesn't matter. But it does mean that we have to face the reality that we live in a world oil market.
Thomas Powell, what about that? It is a huge global market. There's demand all over the place. It's not only ours, it's not only our production, and what's produced here can be sold anywhere. So there again, the assertion that, you know, drill away, even if you said environment be damned, you're not going to really change the price of gas.
Well, first of all, we are only producing on 3% of the federal land. So it's a red herring to come out and say, oh, we could drill on every acre of federal land. We're talking boosted to 10% of the federal estate and see what kind of a difference it's going to make. Secondly, we have 200 years of oil that we can get to right now at today's prices. We could supply our own market with the equivalent of 200 years worth of oil. So this notion that we don't have the resource here and it cannot contribute to the global price is simply not the case. We're the number three producer right now. We can easily get to number one with the resource base we have and the technology that we're deploying. Now, what does that? Why does that matter? Because the real price mover in the global market is spare capacity. And if we are contributing to the increase in global spare capacity, that's when you see the reduction in price. So we can have a big difference. And we need policies at the federal level that reflect that difference. The second thing is the decisions beyond just the land managers in the federal government. The folks who are setting monetary policy are having a huge impact on the price of oil, the world market, because the world crude is based on the dollar. A stronger dollar means a better value for us and for the rest of the world.
So stronger dollar, come on. You know, we listen to this as consumers, and it's hard to figure out everybody's full array of interests. Severin Bornstein is willing to factor in environmental issues here. He's pretty upfront that he's got that as an agenda item, even as he looks at energy prices. What about you, Thomas Powell? I mean, you've got old, long, deep connections to the Koch brothers and their, of course, huge energy industries. I mean, this would be a windfall for them and for the energy business. And how much does that have to do with, I mean, they're talking about this year's politics as the mother of all wars. You're in there with your ads banging away on the president. Is it really about gas prices, or is it about profits for the people who you know very well?
I have no incentive to increase the profits of companies I no longer work for. My goal at this organization is to preach a message that the marketplace is a much better place for these decisions to be made than the decisions that are coming out of Washington, D.C. That's our motivation and that's our effort. And yes, it is for the benefit of the consumer. I'm not for any environmental degradation at all. I think we have the highest standards in the world, and we can continue to have those standards. We have a serious disconnect between the rhetoric that's taking place in this administration, running around saying they're for all of the above on energy, taking credit for the production of oil, and at the same time, for the past 3 years, their policies have been plain and clear that they want us off of that resource. So we should ask them what their motivations are as well.
Thomas Pyle with the American Energy Alliance. Their ads high and front and center in a lot of states as we move deeper into the presidential campaign, banging on the president's energy policy. President of AEA, Tom Pyle, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Joe in Somerville, Massachusetts. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, it really bothers me that people talk about us being oil independent. We don't own the oil. The oil companies own the oil. They could do anything they want with the oil. They would sell it overseas. I know that point has already been made, but It just really frustrates me that we don't own the oil. If the Saudis disrupt the oil supply and world oil prices go up, it doesn't matter that we have a bunch of oil that we're producing. The oil companies own the oil. We don't own the oil. It's not America's oil. It's the oil company's oil. They would sell the oil to the highest bidder.
So you're saying, who's we, Kemosabe? What do you mean we own it? It's the oil company's oil anyway. But if it gets in the market, do you think it could bring the gas price down or not?
The amount of oil that we could produce, if we were producing a lot of oil, from what I understand, would bring the price down minimally. And it's not worth the environmental degradation.
Joe, we've got it. We've got the perspective, and I appreciate it. Severin Bornstein, again, we go to who owns the oil in this case. We talk about American oil, but that would be American profits, right? It would be American jobs.
Well, yeah. So if we produce more oil in the United States, and Joe is right, it would be owned by the oil companies, but it does have some advantages. First of all, it does create jobs. Secondly, it also creates royalty revenues, though we haven't been very good at collecting those royalty revenues. It certainly hit a low under the Bush administration when there were some scandals where we were essentially giving away those royalty revenues to the oil companies. But you know, we do get some value out of that. And more importantly, we do also get value out of the profits. Most of us have pensions, that 401ks or pension programs or some sort. And a lot of that money, if you're just invested in an index fund, for instance, is invested in the oil industry. So some of those profits do flow back to us. At the same time, there's no question that it is disproportionately going to people who are the owners of the oil, and those people on average are richer than the rest of the economy, but they do spend money. And I think there is a good argument from a macroeconomic perspective that if we could produce more oil in the United States, that would help buffer us from these shocks. And we've seen that in the natural gas industry, where we are pretty much self-sufficient in natural gas. And when the price of natural gas goes up, it doesn't create nearly as big a macroeconomic shock as when the price of oil goes up.
Well, you're talking about buffering us economically, but does it buffer us from higher gas prices then or not?
That's a great point. It buffers us economically. It does not buffer us from high gas prices. And that is the point that often gets lost here, that when the price of oil goes up in the rest of the world, it goes up here. And because we are part of that world oil market, and that's a good thing. That helps us get oil from the rest of the world, and it helps us create value through that trade. But it does help in our economy if we're producing something that creates a lot of value. But it's not going to lower gas prices.
Severin Bornstein, please stand by there in California. I want to welcome into our conversation now from Arlington, Virginia, Douglas Holtz Aiken. He's president of the American Action Forum. That is a big advocacy outfit. They poured millions and millions into the 2010 campaign when Republicans did very well for conservative candidates, and poised to do it again. But he's also worked right in the wheelhouse of some very high-placed folks, right up to the president. He was chief economist on the Council of Economic Advisors to George W. Bush. He was director of the Congressional Budget Office. Douglas Holtz Aiken, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. Let me just quickly correct the record. My organization doesn't do advocacy. There's a sister organization that does. It's the American Action Network. But the organization I run is a not-for-profit think tank, and it doesn't do any of the politics you mentioned.
Well,
I would love to have millions of dollars, but I don't.
Hey, you know what? I take that, but you know, there's so many millions, and we can't tell who gives them to you, and it's hard to understand. And you've got plenty that's right there on your side dish, if not right on your plate. So we've got to make the point from both sides, and I wish it were clear. I wish all the money were more public, Douglas, but I appreciate your being with us today. You've written that the president is right about one thing: domestic action to increase production will not lower gas prices set on a global market. So what are you in the Obama camp here?
No, I mean, I'm an economist. We know how prices get set. They get set in a global market. None of that, I think, suggests that we should, you know, avoid opportunities to expand supply. It is certainly the case that what we've seen in world oil markets in 2008, again now, is this awful conjunction of very, quote, inelastic supply. That is, if prices go up, you don't automatically generate more availability, and inelastic demand. People drive almost no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
They expect some, but there are limits to that. And when you get into markets like that, you have the potential for these large price spikes. So in those circumstances, anything you can do to increase supply has some real benefits and perhaps moves prices somewhat. But I think the real issue is the one that was discussed a few minutes ago, which is, you know, what are we giving up when we don't pursue energy options? And there was a recent Wood Mackenzie study that suggested that the president's policies eliminated the equivalent of roughly, you know, 1.3 million barrels of oil per day over the next 5 years, over a five-year period. And that's real cost. Their estimates are 650,000 jobs, $36 billion in the kind of royalty revenues, and those jobs would be the equivalent of about $100 billion. So, you know, those are serious numbers in an economy that really could stand to have more income, could stand to have more revenue, and that has to be factored into the discussion, even if it doesn't move gasoline prices.
So this is kind of a different argument, but Severin Bornstein, it's related to what you were saying. Yes, you could get some economic activity out of this. That's different than lowering gas prices, I guess, but maybe...
Absolutely. But, I mean, if you own the gas station, high gas prices don't look so bad. What we want to do is own more of the energy markets so that when prices go up, we benefit as well as have to pay them.
Severin?
Well, I certainly agree with that, but I think that we need to keep in mind there's a reason that we don't just open up everywhere. That Wood Mackenzie study, which was paid for by the oil industry, by the American Petroleum Institute, take some very, very aggressive assumptions about what we would do, including drilling off the Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast and the Florida coast. And it compares it to what is really a completely unrealistic scenario about what we're actually going to do, which includes blaming the federal government for a lot of barriers that are actually at the state level and reducing production in areas where it's certainly very unlikely.
Severin Borenstein, please stand by there. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, we're talking about gas prices, global markets, and presidential power. 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gas prices, global markets, and presidential power, the price of gasoline in America, and what a president can or can't do about it. You can join the conversation this hour. How are gas prices hitting you, and will they sway your vote this fall? Do you believe the president can bring down the price of gas? What energy posture do you want to see from the White House? Are you ready for drill, baby, drill, and damn the consequences? Anything goes, or would we, could we do that and still face high gas prices in a global market? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Severin Borenstein is with us from the business school, the University of California, Berkeley, Haas Business School there in California. Douglas Holtz-Aiken is with us. He was a former director of economic policy for John McCain's campaign, worked in the George W. Bush administration. He's now with the Conservative American Action Forum, joins us from Arlington, Virginia. There's been a lot of back and forth on this. Here's an interview with Fox News with Greta Van Susteren just last week in Wisconsin, Mitt Romney laying the blame on President Obama for high gas prices.
What he has done is made it harder and harder for the small operators, the drillers, to get more oil, more gas, more coal, to develop these American sources of energy. He's responsible in part for what we're seeing happen around the world, which is people convinced that prices of oil are going to go up.
There's Mitt Romney on the president and gasoline. In his broadcast weekly address last month, President Obama said there were no easy fixes for high gasoline prices.
It's easy to promise a quick fix when it comes to gas prices. There just isn't one. Anyone who tells you otherwise, any career politician who promises some three-point plan for $2 gas, they're not looking for a solution. They're just looking for your vote.
Just looking for your vote, says the president. Severin Borenstein, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, please stand by. A lot of callers here. Iowa City, Iowa, Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, I speak as a liberal Democrat who wishes President Obama well, but I think people who are claiming that he has no responsibility for high gas prices are just wrong. And the reason they're wrong is because they had trouble measuring the impact of war. His threats of war against Iran are obviously driving up prices at the pump, and if he wants to get reelected, it's time for him to lay off.
So but Iran and its nuclear program just take the military option off the table? Is that what you're saying?
Iran presents no threat to the United States. They're a peaceful country. This is a geopolitical squabble in the Middle East that the American people don't support these threats of war against Iran. And his threats against them are driving up the price of gas at the pump.
Well, people
he really ought to lay off of this. He always chooses war when he can. And he ought to lay off of this and help himself get reelected.
Jeff, we've got it. Now, people could disagree about whether or not Iran presents a threat. They clearly do. But what about that factor, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, in the price of oil and therefore gasoline right now?
Well, it's certainly over short periods, those kinds of concerns in the Middle East, geopolitical concerns, have historically, and again, I think in the present, driven up world oil prices. But Over the longer term, it's going to be the supply and demand balance that drives things, the fundamentals. And the reality is the fundamentals in world markets have been ones in which we see increasing demand. As Severin pointed out, the world is developing, and as people come out of poverty, they do want to drive. And that, I think, is a far more important predictor of future prices than anything going on in the Middle East.
Severin, the president says you can't do it short term, but as Douglas Holtz-Aiken says, some of these geopolitical things are short-term. I mean, maybe Jeff's onto something here.
Well, they are, and the tensions with Iran are certainly driving up the price of oil a bit. I think the evidence is it's not the major factor, but it is adding probably $10, $20 to the price of oil. The question is whether that's worth it, given that most people don't agree with the caller and think that Iran really is a significant threat. And that's a sort of geopolitical and defense issue. that we need, the experts need to work out. Obviously, we shouldn't be going around threatening war for no good reason, and particularly in areas that are oil drilling areas. But there is a real concern there, and the fact is that dealing with the real concerns in the Middle East is going to have some impact on the price of oil. Whether the American people are willing to put up with spending another 50 cents a gallon at the pump to address that is another question.
Because Jeff's, our caller is right to remind us that that's definitely part of what we're paying. You have a policy, geopolitics and policies, and yes, they factor in. Vincent in Eola, Kentucky. Vincent, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great.
My question's about the Keystone Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say there's 100 years of oil in Canada, and it would help our neighbor in the north, who is friendly toward us. Why don't they just build the pipeline, bring in the oil, tax it into U.S. refineries, and help the U.S. economy, because it's there, and if we don't do it, the Chinese will.
Yeah, why not? Let's do it. Severin, what about the Keystone Pipeline? Now, the president hasn't made a final decision on that, I guess, but it's certainly been put off. He's given approval to a southern spur there, but it's not the main thing. What do you see coming there, and what about our caller's view? Let's do it. Maybe it'll help. Would it?
Well, it wouldn't help in the price of gasoline.
Why not?
It wouldn't help in the – well, first of all, the oil is going to be produced. Right now, there's no constraint on pulling oil out of Canada. There's enough pipeline capacity. What we're arguing over when we talk about the Keystone Pipeline is whether there's going to be enough capacity 5 years from now.
That's not so far away in energy terms, I guess.
That's right. And it's very likely there will be, either through the Keystone Pipeline as it's currently, or approximately as it's currently designed, or through a pipeline that goes to the West Coast from that area. Either way, that oil is going to get produced and is going to get to the world oil market. The main reason that at least President Obama said that he was holding up the pipeline was not an objection to the tar sands oil being produced in Canada, but to the route that goes through Nebraska, which the Republican governor of Nebraska was also objecting.
And the threat to groundwater there it's posed.
And so when bringing that oil in, as an earlier caller said, doesn't make it our oil. It makes it part of the world oil market, and it would contribute some. Another million barrels a day, which is almost certainly going to get produced one way or the other. So fundamentally, if it creates value, it would create jobs to build the pipeline, but it's not going to change the price of gasoline in any noticeable way.
Douglas Holtzaken, do you agree?
Oh, I think I completely agree on the notion that it's on the world markets, and that ultimately is what contributes to world oil prices. No question about that. Again, it's a question of do you take advantage of opportunities for that oil to come to the U.S., be refined in the U.S., get that value out of the energy sector and provide exports of refined products, which is something the U.S. is increasingly at an advantage in doing. And we're already seeing some of that pipeline get built because there's a little bit of a glut in Cushing, Oklahoma, and this provides a more efficient market. And I think taking advantage of those opportunities is a sensible thing to do. I mean, no one would dispute Severin's basic point, which is you can't do energy policy in isolation from your views on the environmental dangers and the capacity of the technologies to extract mm-hmm. energy products safely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. That's the key public policy issue for the United States.
So you're talking opportunity, but acknowledging there are also opportunity costs on environmental.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course, and people disagree on both, you know, what their preferences are and how big those costs might be. But there are some which I think are you know, pretty straightforwardly no-brainers. The southern part of this Keystone XL can and should and will be built. The last permit's coming regardless of presidential action. And in general, in the U.S., we have lots of sort of lesser noticed regional problems. We have a shortage of refining capacity in the east. There have been some closures in Philadelphia, Delaware, Virgin Islands, and others. And those are policy decisions that we can affect. And once you have the world price of oil, about the only thing that changes gas prices is refinery policy. And that gets lost in this discussion sometimes.
Let's go to Ronnie in Montgomery, Alabama. Ronnie, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thank you. I think that I have an opinion or a view that has not been expressed yet, is that I think that if we opened up 100% of the United States to drill, current petroleum companies would not tap 100% of it. I think they're thinking long-term, 50 years, 100 years down the road. let's buy oil from other countries while it's cheap. We think $100 is cheap or expensive now. Wait 50, 100 years down the road. Let's save our reserves for 50, 100 years down the road when it does get expensive. Let's save it. I don't think they'd tap it all 100% because they've got to think in 50, you know, long term, and yeah. I think our citizens should be thinking long term rather than instant gratification.
So
also,
got it, Ronnie. Be wise, keep it in the ground for when we really need it. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, what do you say?
This is the old Drill America Last program, and that's it's been proposed before. It essentially says we have a strategic petroleum reserve. It's the United States itself, and we should hold on to that. It's a fundamentally a question of how much you want to pay. If you can extract oil $10 more cheaply in the U.S. than outside the U.S., sitting on that oil costs you $10 every day. And you have to decide if having that strategic reserve is worth paying higher prices. And I think the majority of Americans would say no. And we should go ahead and take advantage of those opportunities that we have now, which are competitive at world prices.
Well, you may be right. I don't know what people would say on that. We hear what Ronnie has to say. Let's go to Jay in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering if one of your guests could explain how gasoline is priced, and specifically the concept of last in, first out. And the way I understand it is oil companies can price their gasoline based on the last barrel of oil that they bought. Even if they're producing oil at $20 a barrel, $30 a barrel, $50 a barrel, they can price it as if it were all produced at $100 a barrel, wherever they, you know, the world prices at that time. My understanding is Canada doesn't use this system. I don't know why it's not considered price fixing. And is this something that the president has authority over?
That's interesting. Jay, let us look. Severin Bornstein, what about pricing, how it works? There's a lot of people asking about that online as well.
It's not price fixing. It's how markets work. When you have a resource of any sort, you sell it at the market price. You bought your house for some price, and when you go to sell it, you're going to find out that what you paid for it makes no difference whatsoever. What matters is what the housing market's like around your house right now, whether it's going up or going down. The U.S. oil companies don't control the world price of oil, as they point out frequently, and the fact is that their policies towards pricing oil are set by the world market. They sell their oil for whatever they can get for it. And that's the policy everywhere in the world. That's the policy in Canada, and that's the policy of Saudi Aramco, the Saudi oil company. They sell the oil for what they can get for it. So policies of how they set prices within the company are really not very relevant. They are subject to the world oil market. When the price of oil crashes, they take a bath. When the price of oil goes up, as it has been over the last decade, they make tons of money, just as many of us who owned houses during the housing boom made tons of money selling our houses. And we weren't fixing the price of houses. We were just the lucky recipients of that gain when the price went up.
Well, I mean, you say that they weren't fixed, but we all know that there were monetary policies and there were lending policies that had an awful lot to do with what housing prices became.
That's right. There were policies in the large, but individually, we weren't fixing the price of the houses. And oil companies, well, it's always nice to get to blame some demon. The U.S. oil companies are small enough that they don't move the price of oil.
Some of the biggest companies in the world. But let me just ask you, because there's so many questions about this online. I mean, people are just really not persuaded that there's no speculation going on in driving up crude oil prices, whether oil company or hedge fund or, you know, somewhere in the world of finance. There is a lot. I mean, I'm just seeing, you know, comment after comment here where people are saying, don't believe it. Severin?
There's been a lot of study of this, and overwhelmingly, economists from Paul Krugman on the right to the Cato Institute on the left have said speculation isn't a primary driver. I've looked into it. A number of other oil experts have looked into it. And here's the problem. Mm-hmm. The claim that people are making is that, sure, the price is $120 a barrel, but if we didn't have these speculators, it would only be $60 a barrel, say. Mm-hmm. But if the price is really being set twice as high as the true world market price, that would cut back demand and that would encourage supply. And as a result, what you'd see is inventories going way up. If you charge a price way above the actual market price, you can't sell as much of your product, and we would see a lot more going into inventories. And we just haven't seen that. Mm. And so the evidence to support this idea of speculators driving up oil prices has been this correlation that there are more traders now in the oil market than there were 10 years ago, and the price of oil is higher. But that was also true in the fall of 2008 when the price of oil plunged. There were more traders in the market. So this idea that they're what's driving up the price, I think, is just a misdirection. It's some people's need to have a demon to blame instead of recognizing that it's supply and demand, and we really have to learn to deal with that.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, you've gotten kind of creative here, saying, hey, you know what a president could do? They could do a lot of drilling and use that revenue to actually subsidize the price of gasoline in this country, if I read you correctly, Douglas, and that would bring it down. Are you really for that? You're a Republican.
No, I'm not. But I just wanted to make two points, which was, number one, presidents do have an impact. Their choices, while not immediate, have real impacts on future supplies. That's what we're seeing now. The expansion of leasing under the Bush administration showing up as increased production now, and that new production has economic value, and those are resources that are available in the economy to meet all sorts of needs. And so if people are upset about high gas prices, which I think the evidence is in they are, the value that was foregone is value that could be used to, you know, help overcome the cost of those high gas prices. So it's meant to simply, you know, make the point that not everything is about moving the price of gasoline. A lot of it is about pursuing economic opportunities that make sense and that provide income and wealth to Americans.
Which kind of moves the question, but in effect you're saying it might not bring gas prices down, but some people would have more money in their wallet to make it easier to pay the high prices.
Absolutely, and it's often more indirect. I think Severin made a very good point earlier, which is, oil companies would make more money. That's true, but who owns oil companies? In many cases, they are the pension funds of some of our unions, our state and local employees. Those are valuable contributions to the economy, and so we shouldn't look at energy policy exclusively through the lens of can we change the price of gasoline. There's a lot more at stake.
Severin, do you think ultimately people are going to be voting, if this is their number one issue, are they voting on prices or are they voting on the environment and some trade-off between the two?
Well, I'm an economist, not a political scientist, so I'm not sure how they're going to be voting or whether this is going to play a major role at all. I think that the environmental side of this has really disappeared surprisingly quickly, both from 2008, when both of the primary major presidential candidates were supporting cap and trade for to address climate change, and even since the big oil spill in the Gulf.
Well, here we are, the election now right in front of us in November, and those prices still high. Severin Bornstein at the Haas School of Business, University of California, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Douglas Holtz-Aiken at the American Action Forum, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.